It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. I brought you a story for centering. It's a story by Rachel Naomi Riemann. I bought a little falling down cabin on the top of a mountain. It was so bad that when a friend came to see it, he said, "Oh, Rachel, you bought this?" But with two carpenters, an electrician, and a plumber, in 3 years we've remodeled the whole thing. We started by just throwing things away. Bathtubs, light fixtures, windows. I kept hearing my father's voice saying, "That's a perfectly good light fixture. Why are you throwing it away?" We kept throwing away more and more things. And with everything we threw away, the building became more whole. It had more integrity. Finally, we'd thrown away everything that didn't belong. You know, we may think we need to be more in order to be whole, but in some ways we need to be less. We need to let go, to throw away everything that isn't us in order to be more whole. Healing may not be so much about getting better as about letting go of everything that isn't you. All the expectations, all the beliefs, and becoming who you are. Not a bigger you, perhaps, but a more real you. We remember in prayer this morning those names which we now speak aloud or quietly in the silence of our hearts. I think April Fool's Day demands some foolishness and some seriousness, and I think they should be mixed in unpredictable ways. Now, as a student of religion, not that this matters a whole lot here, I agree with every word that Gershwin wrote in 1935. But the orthodoxy that I want to challenge today isn't from the Bible. That's no fun. There are bigger fish to fry. Most of the time, it's one of the ironies about religion, religions are charged with speaking about life's most important things, and yet everyone expects a church service to be G-rated, no more offensive than a cartoon. Most of the time, people expect their religions to keep them content or happy rather than awake and concerned. Nobody comes to church hoping that they'll feel worse for the trip. But like the little poem on the cover of your order of service, by one of my favorite poets, the Danish poet and cartoonist Piet Hein, I want to mix fun and earnestness today, and we've had our fun. I want to think about one of the oldest pronouncements of religion, which is that love of money is the root of all evil. Not money, but the love of money. I think that's too simple. I think evil has lots of roots, though the love of money is certainly one of them. This is not saying that money's bad or that it isn't good to have it. It just says it can be seductive, that we're easily seduced, and that if we make the mistake of falling in love with money rather than people, the effects can be devastating and deadly. Take the $1 trillion drug business. Whether you're in favor of legalizing all drugs or not, it is clear that the business wouldn't be so big if it weren't so profitable. Or take pornography, which is now a $10 billion a year business in this country. It's routinely attacked by conservatives as though it were some sort of a liberal demon. But when there's that much money to be made, you should expect big businesses to be getting in on it. And they are. The New York Times recently revealed that General Motors now makes $200 million a year from pay-per-view sex films aired through its DirecTV subsidiary. That's more money than Hustler magazine's Larry Flint makes on graphic sex movies. Another big profitable company, AT&T, outsells Playboy in the sex business, offering a hardcore sex channel called Hot Network that reaches 16 million homes on cable TV, plus selling pay-per-view sex in a million hotel rooms. Revenue-wise, says an official with AT&T's cable channel, it's one of our biggest money makers. Now that's an astonishing statement. Revenue-wise, pornography is one of our biggest money makers. And the unspoken ending to that sentence is, therefore, it's a defensible activity for a reputable business. The whole world has changed with that jump. Please understand that I am not bashing the rich. I don't think poor people are any more or less moral than rich people. Given the same temptations, I think the majority of us would probably act the same. And the world doesn't get better merely through good people. It gets better through more just and equitable structures and enforcements. But if the love of money really is one of the roots of evil, then nobody who falls in love with it is likely to be immune. These stories of General Motors and AT&T embracing pornography as good business without asking whether the question should arise whether it's appropriate business or moral business or healthy business. That raises the question of just how far we will go. It looks so easy to have gone that far. How many people, if it came to that, would we be willing to sacrifice given the temptation of enough power, profit, and privilege and the ability to rationalize? It's a sobering question, and it's a big area. Originally, I'd intended to talk just about economics in a kind of sequel to the sermon I gave here last fall on the dark god of capitalism. But I got sidetracked by Bill Moyers' two-hour PBS television program this past Monday. It was called Trade Secrets, and it was about the secret rules that have governed some significant areas of the chemical industries for a long time. I want to use some of that material to sketch a broad picture. Then I want to go into much more detail on just one story that Moyers did not mention. One tragic story that's been unfolding for decades and which has probably touched almost everyone in this room. And then, as in any good sermon, of course, I will tie all this back to this morning's puppet show. The documentation for Moyers' program was several million pages of private letters and intercompany memos obtained from the major chemical manufacturing corporations. There's no assertion, this is probably very important to say, there is no assertion in this that everyone in the company knew about these things. There is the assertion that very few people in any of the companies knew about these things. This is not to tar anyone who worked for a big, good company who was completely unaware of what was going on. It is to say some people knew what was going on, and that's been made public. I hope many of you saw the program. While I took a lot of notes, it was too detailed to repeat, and it would take too long. It was a story documented by the actual confidential memos of some giant chemical corporations like B.F. Goodrich, Dow Chemical, Union Carbide, Esso, and so on, of what I think has to be called the wholesale betrayal of both employees and citizens. It showed that the companies have known as far back as the 1950s that some of their most profitable chemicals were toxic, caused cancer, dissolved bones, sterilized young men, and killed people. They acknowledged this in private letters to each other, as they also insisted that they must all agree to keep this secret from the employees, the government, and the general public. One of the chemicals was vinyl chloride, the key ingredient in PVCs, which you may remember from news stories not too many years ago about how toxic PVCs were. B.F. Goodrich knew as far back as 1959 that vinyl chlorides were toxic and that they posed serious health risks to their employees, which they did. In 1966, while still continuing to manufacture them and sell them, they wrote to Monsanto, Union Carbide, and others that exposure to vinyl chlorides could cause bones to dissolve. They knew this because they had already seen the x-rays of the bones which had dissolved, x-rays which were also shown on this program. Their advisors suggested reducing the concentration of vinyl chloride to less than 50 parts per million, though the concentrations in the factories were 5 to 10 times that high. However, they never published those warnings, and they continued to tell their own employees that vinyl chloride was harmless. In 1973, Union Carbide acknowledged in private memos to the others that the company's secret actions in these areas could be seen as criminal conspiracy. That's quite an astonishing memo. Nevertheless, they continued to cover up, to lie to employees about the deadly concentrations of vinyl chlorides in which their employees were working, and to insist to their employees that these chemicals were perfectly safe. Another famous chemical was benzene. As early as 1958, it was identified as toxic by Esso and other companies. It was linked to leukemia, and they wrote that it was so toxic that only a level of zero could be safe. Also in 1958, Dow Chemical knew that benzene's active ingredient could cause sterility in men and concealed this from their workers, who experienced exceptionally high rates of sterility, which the company insisted were not work-related. As the threat of government regulation gained force in the 1970s, the chemical companies wrote more secret memos to each other, wishing they could find or invent a way to get more money so they could have more political influence, or to put it more cynically, so they could buy more politicians. Finally, before the 1980 elections, PACs, PACs, were created as a way of pooling money to skirt regulations on contributions to buy greater access and influence in politics. This has been spectacularly successful. In his first 33 days in office, Ronald Reagan delayed all EPA regulations of the chemical industry until the EPA could prove their claims conclusively. The rest, you could say, is history. Many of the toxic chemicals are still unregulated. As part of the program, Bill Moyers had samples of his own blood taken and tested. The tests showed that he had 84 foreign chemicals in his blood, including more than 15 in the dioxin family and more than 30 in the vinyl chloride group. It's a good bet that we do, too. These chemicals have been known to be toxic for decades, introducing mutant genes and invented chemical combinations into us at mealtime. These artificial products haven't been well tested. Think about this for a minute, because they cannot be well tested. Why not? Because the slow processes of evolution have not prepared any form of life on Earth to deal with new chemical inventions. There is no way to predict what these new inventions will trigger in response from the life forms into which it's introduced. They are, however, profitable. What will the costs be? We don't know. But already, before we even can begin measuring the effects of genetically manipulated foods, we know that brain cancer in children is up by 26%. There is over a 60% increase in testicular cancer in young men from the profitable chemicals that are already inside of us. At the end of Bill Moyer's program, an executive representing the Chemical Manufacturers Association, I think the association couldn't have picked a worse one. This was not a media savvy man that they had on. And I think anyone who was at all uncertain was probably lost just by his style and presence. While he evaded almost all the questions, he kept saying, "We're a science-based industry." Now, that's not true, and it's worth sorting that out. The chemical industries absolutely use sciences in fundamental, central ways to do what they're doing. The sciences have never driven them to keep deadly secrets from employees or the public. They're a profit-based industry, and it's the concern for profits that drive the secrecy, not the science. I don't think this means they're evil people. I think that would be way too simple. I think it means they're humans. And I have a personal story about this kind of difference and the difference it can make. 16 years ago, while I was writing my dissertation, I was called and offered a job for a year as a staff chaplain at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, a huge hospital in downtown Chicago. The hospital had just been restructured to respond to what the insurance industry called DRGs, or diagnostically related groupings. The length of time the insurance companies would now reimburse the hospital for any patient's stay, was determined not by the attending physician, but by a chart allocating a certain number of days for almost every imaginable sickness or surgery. And coincidentally, very few patients stayed longer than the insurance would cover. Now, you can defend the DRGs by saying they, in turn, were brought in by Medicare and Medicaid to correct gross overbillings by hospitals. So it's a vicious cycle, but it is a cycle. My boss, who had been head of the chaplaincy program there for about 15 years, was struggling to understand what had happened. The hospital's board had been changed from doctors to MBAs and accountants. And each time he returned from a board meeting, he seemed more confused. "Something fundamental has changed here," he said, "and I can't see what it is. Everything sounds the same, but something's changed." After 2 or 3 months, he did see it, and he taught me a lesson I'll never forget. Both the quality and the cost of patient care had always been central concerns of a hospital. They have to be. No hospital can stay in business without attending to both of them. And the same language was still being used, the language of being concerned about the quality and the cost of medical care. But formerly, my boss finally figured out, formerly what they used to mean was, "We try to make medical care as economical as possible, considering our primary commitment to the quality of patient care." Now, while using the same words, the formula had been reversed. Now they were trying to provide the best medical care they could, considering their primary commitment to profitability. It's a subtle change and a revolutionary one. I don't think it's evil. I think it's people responding to a change in laws that puts benefits and enticements in a different area. That's what the chemical companies were saying in the memos exposed in Bill Moyer's television program. They cared about public safety, and they cared about profits. They have to care about both. But they cared more about profits than about public safety when push came to shove. And they quietly sanctioned the disease and death of tens or hundreds of thousands of their employees and fellow citizens because, revenue-wise, it was a big moneymaker. Now, this may be hard to believe, and it is certainly disheartening to believe. But to see both the horror and the cynicism that are represented by letting concerns for profits trump concerns for people without keeping them in a dynamic tension, in other words, we're in trouble. I think the concern for profits is, in fact, governing much of our country now. You may not agree. I want to tell you in some detail now about something that has become an annual national tradition and about which I bet you don't know much. You've all heard of it. It's called Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Last October was the 15th, and the 16th annual Breast Cancer Awareness Month is coming up in 6 months. National Breast Cancer Awareness Month's core message is the importance of early detection, with a special emphasis on regular mammography exams. It also carries the subtle implication, never stated, that breast cancer is just something that's somehow out there without any specific cause that's mentioned, and that if women get it, it's at least partly because they didn't take adequate care of themselves. How can you talk about a disease without wondering what causes it? For 16 years, how can that be? Unless the strings are being pulled from a direction you didn't suspect. Imagine how different this story would sound if we learned instead that breast cancer had been linked to some chemicals commonly found in pesticides and other chemicals produced and marketed by a giant international chemical conglomerate by the name of Imperial Chemical Industries. It sounds like something out of James Bond. It's true. And Breast Cancer Awareness Month was invented by AstraZeneca, one of the subsidiary chemical companies in the conglomerate that produced the cancer-causing chemical. Breast Cancer Awareness Month was not devised as a public service, but as the kind of misdirection that magicians do to distract you from the real trickery. AstraZeneca has always been the primary sponsor of this program, and it has final control over all promotional and informational copy published in connection with Breast Cancer Awareness Month. As a result, no mention has ever been made of some of the known causes of this murderous disease. It isn't about identifying causes. It's about early detection and testing. Now, AstraZeneca is no longer under the giant ICI firm. So it doesn't need to hide the link between breast cancer and the chemicals that were produced by its once parent company. However, AstraZeneca now produces and distributes another controversial chemical called tamoxifen, however that's pronounced, which has been approved to reduce the risk of contracting cancer in women with a high risk of breast cancer. So it still wants to be associated in the public eye with efforts to address breast cancer, though not, of course, with discussing the causes of the cancer or their history with the company involved with the causes of the cancer. How can this go on for 16 years without everyone in the world knowing about it? That's almost a miracle. The official story, celebrated every October, is that we are all blessed by better living through chemistry, and the chemical companies are our life-saving friends in a naturally hostile world. But there's another way of seeing it, and that is that the world is not naturally hostile. It was made hostile and deadly by the very chemicals that this and other companies are polluting us with, knowing full well their murderous effects, and knowing they also make a profit. And as General Motors and AT&T have done with pornography, when these companies come to a fork in the road where profits go one way and concern for people go the other way, their history shows that they seem to follow the profits and create a cynical and intentionally misleading Breast Cancer Awareness Month to hide the evidence that all these women are being killed not by nature, but by them. In this country, about 40,000 women will die of breast cancer this year. The disease has skyrocketed over the past 40 years. No one is asking why or what entered the environment in the past 40 years that might be connected to the disease. During that time, more American women have died of breast cancer than the total of all American soldiers killed in all the wars of the 20th century combined. If there is a more cynical story around, I don't know what it is. Now, we have a new president in our country, and I don't intend to bash him, but every member of his cabinet comes with long-standing and powerful ties to the biggest and most powerful corporations in America. I won't read you the whole list here. It's long. Though I'll put it in the version of this sermon that's put on the website and is made in hard copies. But besides the president and vice president, both of whom come from and represent the Texas oil industry, 12 of President Bush's cabinet members came from, have strong ties to, are paid $100,000 speech fees by, and or will return to, virtually every major corporation in the country. Some people who claim to be knowledgeable in this claim that the corporate control of our national government has never been this complete. If programs like Bill Moyer's expose of the chemical industry and the sad, cynical story of the real origin and purpose of Breast Cancer Awareness Month are fair indications of what lies ahead, we may be entering a chapter in this country's history that we will look back on in shame. I know that many European countries already see it that way. The most fundamental power that rulers can have is the power to write the story within which we agree to live. Those who control a society's story are its invisible puppeteers. The last character in this morning's puppet show, the big parrot, I wrote her as the mother. The mother in this morning's puppet show was an April Fool's joke. There is no mother to keep the rules fair. There's just us. I think that enough rules are out of control that we are on the verge of losing our health, our safety, perhaps our country. And I think that at least some of what I've said here has been persuasive for some of you. I don't hope for much more. You're the brightest and most creative group of people with whom I've ever had the privilege of working, and I wonder if there isn't something that some of us can do in this area to make a positive difference in the lives of ourselves, our children, and the larger community. I'm too disorganized to organize anything. I just think thoughts. But if there are those here who feel drawn to these issues and have some organizational skills or resources, I'll do what I can to help you. There must be many ways in which we can begin to make a positive difference. I don't know what they are. But I keep thinking of that puppet show. Those raccoons and the parrot, they were just puppets. We're not.